a very common thing that a lot of people do that actually ends up being harmful is you go to Sephora or you go to Shoppers Drug Mart and you look at all the products for acne and you try them all.
Welcome to Ditch the Lab Coat with Dr. Mark Bonta, a podcast that examines health issues with a critical eye grounded in scientific skepticism. Disclaimer. The Ditch the Lab Coat podcast is no different than sitting in on a conversation between healthcare professionals at a cocktail party. It is intended to be a fun and informative listening experience that gives all of our listeners a chance to make sense of the fascinating world of medicine. It is a podcast. It is not a substitute for professional medical services, does not establish a doctor-patient relationship, and the use of the information from the podcast or linked materials is at the user's own risk. Basically, if you have a headache that just won't go away, or if your fingers are turning blue and falling off, go to your local emergency department, urgent care center, or see your primary care doctor or nurse practitioner. The content does not aim to replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The expressed opinions belong solely to the hosts and guests, and they do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the hospitals, clinics, universities, or any other organization associated with them. So plug in, enjoy, and get ready to expand your knowledge of all things medical by listening to our fun, evidence-based, and practical conversations. But if your hair falls out after listening to the show, go see a medical professional and don't file a lawsuit against me or my guests. One topic that we haven't covered yet on the show is skin and everything associated with skin. So I felt it was appropriate to invite a well-respected, well-known dermatologist into the virtual studio today to really uncover some of the myths and some of the facts as it pertains to skin care and hair care. Now, skin is something that's been a part of human civilization for a very long time. The ancient Greeks were always seen as people who have glowing golden skin, and light golden skin was considered the height of beauty and fashion. People wondered, what did the Greek people do in ancient times to preserve their skin and maintain this glowing youthful appearance? Was it the honey that they applied to their skin and around their hair? Was it the olive oil that they used to clean and nurture their skin? Or was it simply genetics and sun exposure? Skincare and cosmetics is a multi-billion dollar industry and one that's really ramping up. A lot of these skincare treatments and things that people apply to their skin actually have some of those compounds that the ancient Greeks used. Think about Burt's Bees, which is honey-based, and think about the olive oil that often exists in many of the skin creams and moisturizing lotions that patients apply. Looking outside of creams and looking at injections, Botox, fillers, what do these things do? Do they help? Do they hurt? What about sun exposure? Is wearing sunscreen really that important? Am I going to get cancer if I don't wear sunscreen? Isn't having a nice tan something good for me and good for my skin? What about all of those things I've heard about on TV? Chocolate, poor sleep, alcohol, smoking. How do I maintain that young and youthful appearance? And how do I manage other chronic medical conditions that can lead to skin changes and disfiguration? Thinking back to all of the teens out there in the audience with acne, people who have lived with acne and then have acne scars that have changed the appearance of their face. What about all the men out there who are experiencing male pattern baldness and hair loss? What works? Do pills work? Do creams work? Do hair transplantations work? Well, what better way to separate fact from fiction and have all of our questions answered smartly and in an evidence-based fashion as it pertains to skin and hair than by having a medical professional and dermatologist who does this on a daily basis join us in the studio? And that's who we have today. We have Renita Aluwalia, who is a self-professed skin doc who applies evidence to ensure that your skin shines. She is the founder of the Canadian Dermatology Center in Toronto, which is a full-service dermatology, plastic surgery, medical spa, and hair transplant center. She works as a lecturer at the University of Toronto. And yes, you do need to go to med school for this. It's a misconception that she wants people to know. Most dermatology residents have some of the most rigorous and intense training programs that I've seen out there. All of the dermatologists in training are routinely amongst the smartest people that I have worked with and trained. So I am really excited to welcome someone so established, someone so experienced, and someone who is so articulate into the studio today to go over skin, hair, and health. What works, what doesn't work, and what can you be doing at home to maintain good skin and hair health? So let's get right into this episode today. Renita, thank you very much for taking the time to join me today in the virtual studio for the podcast.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
You're a dermatologist. And one thing I want to clarify from dermatology, as someone who's worked in medical education and residency, I've trained a lot of learners, and I always get a dermatology learner, a dermatology resident, or a dermatology keener from the medical student group. And in general, I have very high expectations of them. They're generally quite smart, quite motivated, and I like working with them. But one common thing I've noticed about dermatology residents and dermatology keeners is they have good skin, and they have always have good skin creams at home. Is that true or false?
I think that is generally a true statement. I think dermatology does attract people who are interested in skin care and looking after their skin. You know, there's a huge aesthetic component to the profession, and most dermatology keeners, as you say, are interested in that. So the best example is yourself, right?
Well, my one of my good buddies in residency was a dermatology resident, and we went traveling. We had 2 weeks off in residency, and we went to Indonesia traveling. And in my suitcase, I had swim shorts and t-shirts and that and sunglasses. And in his suitcase, he had that stuff, but he also had a lot of creams. He had a lot of sunscreens, and he had things with retinol. And retinol is something that we see in skin creams out there. And he's like, oh, I wear this and I put this on my face every day and I put it on my neck because I want to look 5 years younger forever. So what is retinol? Like, what does that do? I see it in some of the over-the-counter skin creams. I think what he had were actually samples from pharmaceutical companies of like higher percentages. And what is retinol? Where does it come from? Does it work? And does it make you look younger?
Yeah, great question. So smart man, because the number one thing with the most evidence for anti-aging and protecting your skin, preventing dark spots, preventing fine lines and wrinkles is actually sunscreen. That's something that everybody should be wearing 365 days a year. And people who have, you know, more pigmentation in their skin need sunscreen that has visible light filters in it. So visible light filters are usually give sunscreen its tint, like iron oxide. And visible light, especially in people with more pigmentation in their skin, makes the reds and the browns and the lines in the skin worse. So sunscreen is the number one thing. And probably the number two thing that has the most scientific evidence behind it in skincare is retinol. Retinol or retinoic acid or tretinoin in its more potent forms that are available as medications do a lot of different things. Usually the medical indication is acne, but people are using it for anti-aging and pigmentation. And this is because retinols do a lot of different things. They help with collagen stimulation. They help with fine lines and wrinkles. They help with pigmentation. It's actually a smart family of molecules that can help regulate the skin. So if the epidermis is too, the top layers of the skin are too thin, it can help to thicken them. If there is hyperkeratinization there or thickening of the skin there, it can regulate it to actually make it a little bit thinner. So it's a smart molecule that has a lot of different functions in dermatology, but the truth is they're not all created equally. So a lot of the products over the counter don't have the testing to show that they actually bind to the receptors and they actually work and they actually do those things. Some of them do, but a lot of them don't. Whereas the prescription molecules do have more evidence, and some of them do have evidence for even anti-aging components. And then there's, you know, cosmeceutical grade ones that have recently come to Canada that are very exciting because as a dermatologist, our biggest struggle is educating people about retinols, how to use them, because they're not foolproof. And as medical students, as dermatology residents, even experimenting with these good things, you know, you run into problems. And the main one is dryness and irritation. And then you can also get some photosensitivity too. So maybe on a 2-week vacation in Indonesia might not be the best time to slather on a lot of retinol. But with some of the newer cosmeceutical grade products, you are able to maintain efficacy and still have tolerability, which is great. And with the prescription retinols, I always tell people to go slow once a week, moisturize afterwards. A lot of people do this moisture sandwich technique where they moisturize first, put the prescription product on, and then moisturize afterward to make it more tolerable. But then you are decreasing efficacy because it's not contacting the skin as much and you're not using it as frequently. But it's still a good idea to incorporate into your skincare routine, and you will see the benefits. But it's not a short-term benefit. In the short term, you can have irritation. So stick with it, find a way to make it work. And then in the long run, 6 months, 1 year, 5 years, you will notice improvements in your skin.
But if I want to look young, because everyone wants to look young, everyone doesn't want to age for some reason. If I want to look young and I slather retinol, prescription-based or even the high percentage-based over-the-counter ones that I would get at a drugstore or something, should I slather those all over my body every day from the time I turn 12 and I will look young forever? Or is this going to have some marginal improvement in skin in certain areas? Like, I think people put these creams over their faces, right? People don't like getting wrinkles and that type of thing. But are there people who slather this over their entire bodies? Will that do anything for you? And outside of photosensitivity, which is kind of sensitivity to light and maybe some dryness, can you get serious problems from slathering retinol all over your body, like cancers and other diseases from that?
Certainly not cancer. In fact, you know, oral molecules that are the same as this are sometimes actually used for cancer prevention in low doses for transplant patients. So certainly not cancer. People do use retinols, and there are studies to show improvement for anti-aging purposes on the neck, on the hands, in different areas of the body. It's safe to use because systemic medications in this class, like pills that you take, in this class, they can cause birth defects. We don't recommend pregnant or breastfeeding women use them, although there are no real studies to show that's the case with a topical, right? And the amount that would get systemically absorbed is quite low. But I guess if you were slathering it all over your body and you were pregnant, you could have problems. But you can develop severe irritation from retinol. So never just slather it everywhere. Start slow and listen to your skin and build up as tolerated.
And so, you know, you referenced using this to treat conditions like acne, which we'll get to. And I know Accutane, which is one of the big pills to manage acne, is something that you have to counsel patients on because it can theoretically lead to birth defects. And what you're saying is some of the same compounds, when you put them on your skin or you slather them in, are less likely to be absorbed and to cause those downstream impacts. So it's an implausible and theoretical downstream impact of putting these creams on. But by and large, there's no major bad things happening with them. What I wanted to step on before I get back to asking you about acne is there are some misconceptions or perhaps truths going out there on the podcast world and internet about sun exposure. And so there are some kind of medical podcasts out there and medical websites out there that are basically pop culture. And one of the themes that have come through, you might have heard of things like carnivore diets and, you know, extreme intermittent fasting, eating every 1 or 2 days. But one of them is the value of being exposed to UV radiation and sunlight. One of the ascribed values and benefits to exposure to natural sunlight is when it hits the back of your eye and the retina, that can stimulate your biological and evolutionary centers to help you recognize it's the morning, to kind of manage some of your circadian rhythms, your sleep-wakefulness cycles. But some people say that putting sunscreen on is actually harmful because your body should be exposed to sun. And when the body's exposed to sun, it's a natural stimulus for your body and for your skin that you're an animal who is out there outside being exposed to the sun. And this helps to adjust your rhythms. And good sun exposure actually leads to less incidences of bad things like cancer. And I listened to a podcast on a very famous show, The Huberman Show, where he actually speaks with Rick Rubin, who's a music producer. And Rick Rubin talks about how he has perfect skin because he's never worn sunscreen. And he walks out in the sun all the time, and this is good for his body. And if he put sunscreen on, maybe he would be getting cancers. So is sun exposure good for you? Is it bad for you? Do sunscreens make a huge difference? Is the jury still out? What does the science say about that stuff?
Well, absolutely. We know that sunburn and excessive sun exposure can lead to skin cancer. That is a well-established fact. And we know that wearing a proper broad-spectrum sunscreen that's at least an SPF 30 or higher that protects against UVA and UVB will reduce your risk of developing skin cancer and sunburns. We also know, like for people who are investing in anti-aging treatments and do not want to look older, that sun exposure is the number one cause of aging in the skin. And, you know, there's lots of prime examples, and a photograph is often worth a thousand words. There's like this, I think it was in Time magazine, this photograph of a milkman who drove with half his face outside of his truck his whole life. And he actually looked like two different people. The left side of his face had skin cancers and solar elastosis, which is damage from the sun that makes the skin look saggy and wrinkled. And you can also get different types of like pimples and pustules on top of that. So he actually looked like two different people. So I think the gentleman you're referring to is probably just really lucky genetically, because there is an overwhelming amount of evidence that the sun causes skin cancer.
All right.
And sunscreen protects against skin cancer.
So good quality sunscreen with high SPF prevents a lot of downstream bad things from happening to the skin. And that's just not a personal opinion, but that's based on a lot of science and evidence, which is how us as medical professionals generally provide our recommendations to patients and family members. And I think this common thing that we see and we hear about in pop culture today is when people reference that person they know, or my uncle's best friend, or my buddy from high school. And then it quickly becomes a narrative. You know, my buddy only eats steaks and never wears sunscreen, and he's in perfect health. That's a sample size of one. But if you had 100 people doing exactly that, maybe the other 99 would be in bad shape. And I think it's important to recognize that. And the decisions that we make and recommend are often based on these large sample sizes and data, but not looking at Uncle Joe's Facebook page. Now, acne is a very interesting thing, because I know it's a common skin condition that many teenagers deal with, right? There's a big association with hormones and hormonal change. And I'm sure there's a lot of noise out there on the internet when they're looking at Uncle Joe's Facebook page or when they're searching. I think it can be something very troubling to teens and adolescents. So when it comes to acne, what works?
So definitely teens and adolescents get acne, but they're not the only ones who get acne. Most of the acne patients in my practice are actually women in their 20s and 30s because of, like you mentioned, hormones and hormonally related changes. So I think, you know, it depends on the patient. There are so many really great options for treating acne now. So the first thing I do when someone comes in with acne is we take a detailed history and we examine their skin and we see what kind of triggers they have, if they play certain sports, if they're not using the proper cleansers. Then we establish first a proper skincare routine. Acne and diet is a controversial topic, but what I think is if anything puts a stress on your guts or anything like physical, emotional, any type of stress, it can flare your skin, whether that's acne or eczema or psoriasis or any skin condition. There is a lot of evidence that any type of stress, including dietary stress, can flare that. And there's one small study that implicates dairy in hormonal acne specifically. So we do touch on those, but I don't recommend typically any dietary changes. Then we establish like a proper skincare routine of like cleansing, moisturizing, SPF, and then we focus on active ingredients, whether they're, you know, over-the-counter or cosmeceutical grade or medical grade skincare or prescriptions, and make sure that that is optimized. And, you know, retinols, often we use those. There's lots of different ingredients that are very popular. Like there's a new hormonal acne product that just came in the market. So I use a lot of that in my practice. There's different antibiotic combinations. There's a lot of products that contain alpha hydroxy acids to help smooth the skin and pigmentation that people get after acne. So those are like lactic acid and glycolic acid. There's salicylic acid, which is a good product as well. What's recently another really popular product is benzoyl peroxide, and it's kind of recently been all over the news because there's been controversy about it because there were certain studies that showed that it contained benzene in a lot of the commercially available and prescription products. But there's so many alternatives that if people are concerned about that, we've been using more of other products. But the truth is, most of those studies show that in order for there to be benzene in those products, they need to be stored at very high temperatures in order for that reaction to take place. So at this point, I'm not so concerned about it, but it is something that's coming up a lot in my office. Then there are lots of different oral treatments. Some people use oral antibiotics for like anti-inflammatory purposes. There are like hormonal options, like a lot of women take birth control pills or anti-androgens like spironolactone. And then we talked briefly about Accutane, which is an oral retinol, isotretinoin, and it's available in different formats that can improve the skin in a lot of people. And we do a lot of laser therapies too. There's actually a laser that's approved for acne. You can put it into like an Accutane-like remission. And there's different lasers to reduce inflammation and redness. And we do chemical peels with alpha hydroxy acids in our office too. So there are lots of different ways to control the acne. It depends on patient preferences, the type of acne, budget. But I love treating acne because you see people, and often young people, who come in and it's really affecting their quality of life and their self-esteem. And if, you know, they stick to the plan, we see really great results and it really improves the quality of their life. And you see it sort of change the trajectory of their life when their skin is clearer, like they are doing better in school, they're more social. And so I find it really rewarding to treat.
So why do people get acne? You mentioned antibiotics, and I know this is a bacterial issue as well, but then there's skin treatments that you're giving. You're talking about skin peeling and chemical treatments. Is it purely genetic? Is it bad luck? Is it a chronic bacterial infection? Do they know that?
So it's not a chronic bacterial infection, but there is a bacteria that is involved in the pathogenesis of acne. It's called Cutibacterium acnes. So that's one of the factors. People who have acne have more of this bacteria. And then there's inflammation in the skin that also leads to acne. The skin cells also turn over quicker, leading to comedones, which are like blackheads and whiteheads. Then there's overactivity of the sebaceous glands. So those are like the four main causes of acne. And hormones, like you said, can drive that process. So that's kind of on the side. So all those play a factor. And yes, someone has to be genetically predisposed, and then they have some type of stressor that brings it out. And those can be the hormonal changes, physical stress, emotional stress, and those factors all interplay to cause acne.
Does chocolate give you acne? I remember that was a big thing when I was a teenager.
Generally, chocolate does not give you acne, but some patients do feel that when they eat sugary foods, their skin conditions flare. And you know, not specific for acne, but sometimes for other conditions that we treat that are sometimes similar to acne, there is some evidence that that could be the case. So I always tell people, look at what, like if anything, it makes you feel unwell or your body finds it hard to digest, then eliminate it. And you can see some improvements in your skin.
Now, I think about patients that I care for with medically unexplained physical symptoms. So I have an interest in that and some expertise in that. So I think about chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, chronic Lyme disease. And when I see people, they're desperate. They've seen all sorts of specialists and they've been told nothing's wrong with you, right? They've had a lot of normal tests, but they're struggling. And people go on the internet, people talk to friends, they try all sorts of things to see if they can get better. And some of the things that they do are actually quite dangerous. What are some of the things that you've seen some of your patients do in desperation to manage acne that are actually quite harmful and things that people should be mindful of and aware of so that they don't cause harm to themselves when they're trying to manage this skin condition?
Well, I think a very common thing that a lot of people do that actually ends up being harmful is, you know, you go to Sephora or you go to Shoppers Drug Mart and you look at all the products for acne and you try them all. And people are using so many different things and layering them on the skin. And it's actually causing irritation, which is disrupting their skin barrier, which is actually leading to more acne and more inflammation and putting the skin in a worse state. So that's the common thing that I see. But the really dangerous things I see are sometimes when people are mixing like different herbal medications that they don't know what they're on and they maybe don't disclose it to their provider. Then the provider prescribes something like Accutane and there can be interactions in the liver and people can get really sick. When I was a resident, I saw, you know, a young man who was admitted to the hospital because of liver toxicities, because of combining, isotretinoin with herbal medication. So that was a lesson for me that to always ask about those things, but sometimes people don't even disclose it, right? Because they think it's nothing. So I always specifically ask about those things too.
And so I'm old now, I'm 44. And when I was a teen or 20-year-old, I remember there are all these ads for this stuff, Proactive. I don't know if that's still out there, but that was like on every second commercial when I was watching Beverly Hills 90210 and all those kinds of shows. Is that still out there? Is that based in science? Does it do anything?
I remember begging my parents for Proactive and my dad was a family doctor and he was like, I have all these other things. Like I have samples in my office. You can just use some of this stuff. It's better. And I was like, no, I need this. It's going to clear my skin. And so now as a dermatologist, I wish I invented Proactive. It's actually a nice system to look after your skin. The active ingredient, like back in the day, was just benzoyl peroxide. And then they had a mask that contained sulfur that dried out some of the pimples. It's a nice regimen. And for like mild and even moderate acne, it's a good, you know, three-step system for like looking after your skin. And is it overpriced for what the ingredients are? Probably, but the marketing was very successful. The packaging was nice. They did have active ingredients in it that worked. Is it going to fix like severe cases of acne or fix everyone's acne? No, but we talked about establishing a good skincare routine. And certainly for many patients, that is a very good skincare routine.
What if you just do nothing? Does acne just go away eventually?
For most people, acne will go away eventually. But the problem is it leaves scarring and that scarring doesn't, you know, that scarring can often be permanent. And that we know acne scarring leads to a lot of psychosocial problems in people's lives. And if we are able to prevent that permanent damage to the skin, we're doing people a real service for the trajectory of their lives.
Well, it's 2024. So don't we have like a laser or something that can make the scarring go away?
I do. I have lots of fun devices that can help improve acne scarring. And we do a lot of acne scar treatments because people are bothered by them. So there are lots of great options. We do a ton of radio frequency microneedling, which is needles and laser energy going deep into the skin to stimulate collagen in the different layers of the skin. And that really improves scarring a lot. So we're using your body's ability to make collagen to improve the scars. So we do that a lot and see really good results, especially in younger patients. There's different types of lasers you can do too, like to ablate the skin surface, like CO2 lasers. We do some of that in fair skin types. So yeah, there's lots of fun things to do with lasers that we didn't have in the past to really improve scarring. But if you can prevent it in the first place, it's even better. These things are costly. They're not without a little bit of pain. You know, there's lots of options though.
What about microdermabrasion? I've seen this advertised in lots of places. It sounds pretty cool, but I have no idea what it is or if it actually works or it's something that you'd recommend. Do you know anything about microdermabrasion?
Yeah, I mean, microdermabrasion is not really something most dermatologists keep in their office. There's different like devices and different like ways to stimulate collagen in the skin. Microdermabrasion can refer to different machines that are like taking some of the top layers and peeling some of the top layers of the skin off. And it can be helpful. But as far as acne scarring goes, it's typically a deeper problem. And you want to actually do microneedling, or even better than microneedling is the radio frequency microneedling, where you can put the needles at different depths of the skin and the laser energy to go with that. So there's lots of better options than just plain like dermabrasion.
So if I put on sunscreen all the time, if I consciously and sparingly applied retinol-based creams, and I did radiofrequency needling, would I look perfect forever?
You're still going to age, and collagen production, which is shocking, goes down at age 25. And as you get older, your body's ability to make collagen continues to go down. But people who want to be proactive about these things and people who want to look younger for longer certainly should wear sunscreen, certainly should use retinol. There's also some evidence for antioxidants and boosting the effect of your sunscreen, like vitamin C. So I do suggest those three things for most patients. And then, yeah, procedures that are building your collagen bank can be helpful in the aging process. So radiofrequency microneedling stimulates a lot of collagen. There's also ultrasound and infrared modalities, different modalities that are targeting different layers of the skin to build that collagen bank. I think the more you do, the younger you are, the more collagen you're building, and you will age better. And we see that in people, like we see that in our office every day, people who are committed to a regimen for positive aging and making a 360-degree plan with us. We see the results. Those people look better now than they did 5 years ago. So you're going to age. There will be changes, but you'll look better for sure.
Now, what about things like Botox and like lip fillers and collagen injections? You know, those are very commonplace right now. And I think all of us can tell when someone's doing that.
No, you can't tell. You can't tell. If it's done poorly, you can tell. If it's done well, you can't tell. The best injectable is undetectable. You can't tell. But there's so many bad examples walking around that people are terrified of these things. When actually most people who are getting them, you can't tell that they're getting them because they just look natural and good. And that's the number one fear that patients have when they come in to see me, is that they're going to look unnatural and people are going to know that they're doing those things. But they quickly realize that in the right hands, with the right approach and things in moderation and put in the right place, you can't tell. And you actually, the whole idea is you look better and no one really knows why.
So when people look funny, right? I put it that way because their skin may look more taut and their skin may look younger. Their lips may look more full, but they look abnormal. That would be reflective of inappropriate administration or abnormal administration, or even these kinds of borderline plastic surgeries that are changing someone's kind of facial composition. But what you're talking about is injectable treatments. I'm assuming this is just Botox, but you're suggesting other things when done properly doesn't look that way. So if you look like, wow, that person looks younger, I don't quite know what it is. It's probably being done well and appropriately. But if someone looks straight out of a Michael Jackson kind of time-lapse photo shoot, then you're saying, well, that's done inappropriately. Is that what you're getting at?
That's absolutely right. Like, and we see so many people walking around who look like that. And I see sometimes those people come into my office and they're not happy they look like that. They've gotten bad advice, or their goals, or they ask for, sometimes patients ask for something like, oh, I want bigger lips. But you look at their face, they don't need bigger lips, and they're not even really asking for bigger lips. They're asking you to improve how they look. So educating around that. And I always take the time, like the first time someone comes to see me, and make that 360 degree plan and educate them about what different modalities we can use to make them look better. And I'll share with you like how we do that. But a lot of people who come in and they've been somewhere else, they have like, they look unnatural. As I get to know them, I point out that, you know, we can deflate this, we can do this. And they are always very grateful because they don't want to look weird or strange, right? So just because a lot of people don't actually know, and especially people who are scared. So Botox is a type of neuromodulator. And what neuromodulators do, and there's five in Canada, is they relax the muscles. So they're preventing wrinkle formation. So people often use them in the forehead or around the eyes. We can do different things in the neck and around the mouth too, to lift and improve appearance there as well. But it has to be completely customized to the patient so it looks natural. And you don't necessarily have to be frozen. You know, you can do it so there is movement. And the other thing that's really nice is it retrains your brain. So you end up not moving some of those muscles as much, so those lines don't form. Now, classic fillers are made of hyaluronic acid, And hyaluronic acid is a very safe ingredient, and it can plump and contour the skin. So when put in the right places, and we put it all over people's faces in small quantities to lift and restore proportions, to improve sagging. So when we combine those treatments with, you know, our lasers and devices, everything in small amounts in moderation, people have a very positive plan for looking their best. There's also other types of fillers that we use a lot too that contain things that make your body make collagen. And, you know, collagen is like one of the number one searched terms on Google. Everyone is trying to make their bodies make collagen to improve their skin, improve their bones, improve their joints. So certainly there are lots of different things we can do in office to improve that.
But doesn't there get a point where like you should just look like you're 90, right? Like, are there going to be in, because we don't know, right? The age of Botox and fillers and all of these creams even that are out there. It's a new frontier. And there are people I'm sure who are now, you know, my age in their 40s who have been doing this for 10 or 15 years. But when they turn 80, 90 or 100, right? Because now we have, you know, anti-aging and all that. Are they going to look weird when they're 100? Or are people going to say like, you're really like, there's no way you're 100. You look like you're 40 years old. Like, is there an end to all of this? Is there a point in time where you just can't get any more Botox or can't get any more fillers because it's not going to make a difference? And then when that happens, do things just unravel quickly? Or what do you think the future is going to look like?
I think that's an interesting question. I think if you're like, it's just a lifestyle. Like if you're committed to it, it's part of wellness now for a lot of people, right? Like if you're committed to a healthy lifestyle and you're exercising, you're eating well, you're taking certain supplements, part of that is your skin health. And people just look at it as an investment in their skin health. So what can they do to stimulate collagen in their skin? What can they do to protect their skin? And these things are safe. They're studied. And I think what you'll just see is those people will generally age better if it's put in the right place and they're doing the right things and they have proper advice. I think people will look better for longer. Certainly you will age and certainly you want to be natural. And I sometimes have patients who are in their 70s who have never done anything come in and they want to do everything. And at that point, you're like, well, you know, does this make sense? Like, what are your goals? But if I have a lot of patients who start when they're younger and they're in their 70s, they're in their 80s. They look older, they look age appropriate, but they look great, you know, and they're happy with how they look and they're committed to this plan of positive aging. So I think it's a lifestyle. I think it's part of the whole wellness lifestyle. So certainly there's examples out there that look bad, but when it's done appropriately, it looks really good. And I think it makes people feel better and they feel more confident in their appearance and that, you know, look good, feel good.
So yeah, if you're talking about lifestyle, you know, it's a commitment to a host of things. And it sounds like some of these treatments, right, Botox and fillers are part and parcel of a larger package, right, which probably includes managing your mental health, appropriate sleep, diet, hydration, exercise, protection from the sun, all of these things together. And I know the classic story that we always hear about is the rock star who's smoking and drinking and has bad skin. Is that true? Do some of those lifestyle factors, namely cigarette, drug use, and alcohols, like the rock and roll lifestyle, can that lead to bad skin or rapid aging? Or is that just a myth?
No, and there's evidence that all those things are true. They're oxidants, right? And so for, you know, which cause DNA damage, which, you know, affects all our organs, including the skin. So definitely those things have a big impact on the skin.
So it's not good to party like a rock star. And I'm sure if you met a lot of the kind of rock stars and actors and actresses today, most of them are by and large being managed well and maintaining their lifestyle well because it's a business, right? I note that in your Canadian Dermatology Center, which you founded and work in, you offer a host of things, full service dermatology, ranging all the way to hair transplant. So as a male in their 40s, whose hairline is perhaps receding a little bit, and the inevitable hair loss thing will be a part of my future. What's the deal with hair transplants? I know people go to Turkey and they get hair taken off of their chest and transplanted in their head. People get injections, people get pills. What works for hair loss?
Yeah, so the way we look at it, it's a game of keeping and replacing, right? So to keep the hair, there's lots of different things you can do. So the first thing we do is we make sure the blood work is okay. We make sure your iron stores are good, your thyroid is good, your vitamin D levels are good. Then we look at what you're doing topically. Like there are things like minoxidil or Rogaine that can help to maintain hair. We can make different combinations too, where we can combine some oral medications in a topical form, like finasteride, which is a androgen blocker, with minoxidil. For women, we sometimes combine it with an antiandrogen called spironolactone, and we can make those in topical formats. There's also some evidence for some over-the-counter products. The one ingredient that's kind of cool is called Aminixil. It improves like the hair's anchorage to the shaft. So there's a lot of topical things we talk about. And then after we do that, we talk about in-office procedures. So PRP can be beneficial. That's where we take your blood, we spin it, we take the platelet-rich part and inject it back into the scalp. That can stimulate some follicles. There's different serums we can put into the scalp with that too, that have some evidence that the hair can regrow. There's some low grade evidence for those red light helmets. There's a couple companies that have okay studies. So hair is very hard to keep. So if you can do all those different things in combination that suits like your budget and your time, you will get better results. And then finally, it's the transplant. And so that's the replacement. So there are different methods for doing hair transplantations. The donor site is the back of the head typically, and sometimes we do a strip where a strip is taken from the back and follicles are implanted into the front or the crown or wherever you need them. And then there's also a method called follicular unit extraction where there's no strip, so there's no scar in the back, and those follicles are moved to the areas where you need them. You know, often people will need more than one hair transplant because as time goes on, you will lose more hair. And sometimes to restore even what you've already lost, you need more grafts and more than one transplant to be arranged.
Wow. So when I think about transplants, like my life is used to dealing with patients who have had liver transplants and lung transplants, which by and large, you're getting an organ from someone else, right? Maybe a family member or maybe someone who's passed away in a car accident or something. But a hair transplant isn't coming from someone else. It's coming from yourself.
Those are your own hair. There was actually a funny episode of Arrested Development where the guy got a hair transplant from someone else's hair. And he developed what we see sometimes in transplant patients, graft versus host disease. But in real life, you would never get a hair transplant from someone else's hair.
Yeah, but like John Stamos, like I would like his hair. Like, could you get a hair transplant from someone else, or would your body reject it like it can do with livers and lungs and you need to be on anti-rejection medicines?
Exactly.
Done that? Have they studied that?
You know, I haven't looked to see if that's ever been reported. Like, I certainly will, but I think you cannot. I think it could potentially be the same type of adverse outcomes.
Well, because there's everything out there, right? Like, I know people have had parts of their joints and tendons replaced with animals. We'd replace heart valves with pig heart valves.
Totally.
And when you kind of talk about the people who are looking unnatural, right? And some people choose to look that way. Some people have done some very kind of insane plastic surgeries in that. Do you think there's ever going to be a person or someone who's like wanted cat fur and has wanted an animal hair transplant? Like, like, why can't we get an animal's hair on our head? Is that possible?
Well, I don't think anything cosmetic is worth taking like anti-rejection medications for, right?
Yeah, but I want to look like Garfield.
And I guess that's your personal personal choice. But, and you never know, like you could probably find a practitioner somewhere in the world who might want to experiment with that with you, but certainly not something I'd advise.
So I've learned a lot talking with you about these various things, ranging from, you know, acne to Botox and fillers and hair transplantation. And as a healthcare professional, I know that I often have the same conversation with patients on a daily basis. And in fact, this morning I was doing nuclear stress tests and I give a chemical to simulate exercise. We then take special pictures on a nuclear camera. And I sometimes want to record what I say the first time and just press play the next four times that I say it and do that every Tuesday, because I do this every Tuesday morning. I'm having the same conversation. But for patients, it's the first time they're hearing that and it's important. And there are actually a lot of things that I repeat to patients if I'm caring for congestive heart failure, if I'm talking about placing a cardiac stent for a heart attack, if I'm talking about treating an infection. So reflecting on your practice as a clinical dermatologist, list. What are some of the common things that you say over and over? And if you were to say the top three things that you repeat in your practice to patients or common themes, what are they?
So number one is wear sunscreen. And I do talk about retinols and antioxidants for the skin. I say that like the sunscreen to every patient and the retinol and the antioxidants for to every patient who's interested in anti-aging, which is almost every patient, medical or cosmetic. So that's one of the things I say all the time is that little focus on skincare. I also, you know, and it's a little bit unique towards a patient, but I always remind patients that who are coming in and they want like one specific thing to look at the global picture, because that's how you achieve a natural outcome and you avoid looking artificial or distorted. So I always talk about 360-degree planning with everyone and touching on what you can do with skincare, what you can do with injectables, what you can do with a laser, what you can do with surgery. So you get a very natural outcome. And what would be the third thing that I say all the time? I say lots of things all the time. Like I have like a moisturizing routine, like for anyone with dry skin that I probably say 100 times a day, that I put on a card. And basically what it says is use like a soap that's close to the pH of our own skin, which is 5.5. Come out of the shower when the skin is still damp. If I gave you any prescriptions, put those on. And then over top, unscented, unfragranced moisturizer. Don't use any scents or fragrances, no bounce sheets, no fabric softeners, and use unscented detergents. You can see how quickly I said that. I say that every day, at least multiple times a day. And I have that printed on a card.
Well, I'm sure you need to. I did a few dermatology rotations in my training, and you guys would see, some of the dermatologists are seeing 100, 120 patients in a day. I don't know if you're in the same range, but I'm sure that you see many, many people a day, and having some of that information is quite helpful at consolidating the information, but also help you deal with that throughput so that you can see all these people who have been waiting to meet you and get your expertise. So Renita, thank you so much for joining me in the studio today and making time out of your busy day to share your wisdom and collective expertise in this conversation today. I learned a lot, and it will certainly be helpful in counseling and sharing information with patients, and also for self-care at home and self-care with my family and children. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. It was my pleasure, and I'm very excited about your podcast.
That was super fun and super interesting. One of the things that really stuck with me after that conversation with Dr. Ahluwalia was when she described the left side, right side of the person who did sun protection with sunscreen and the person who didn't, and the person who didn't do sunscreen kind of worsened over time. And it really made me think about those pictures of the faces of meth, you know, where people who were addicted to methamphetamines had frequent incarcerations, and then they took their mugshots side by side over time, and it showed this gradual deterioration, you know, with the teeth falling out and people developing sores all over their mouths and around their faces and just kind of falling apart over time. And the reason I asked all those questions to Renita about what the impact is going to be of all of these treatments, not just the skin creams, but Botoxes and lip fillers, is eventually over time, when you think about those people who have had botched plastic surgery or repeated plastic surgery over time, is the same thing going to happen to people who are essentially addicted to that youthful appearance and those cosmetic procedures? And it was really reassuring to hear that if done properly and if done well, people can maintain that youthful appearance without disfiguring themselves. But what I really took home from that conversation was the importance of some of the general factors that can promote skin health: good mental health, a good diet, adequate protection from the sun and sun exposure with sunscreens, and not putting things into your body that can cause harm and wear and tear over time. Those principles, by and large, not only help us maintain good and healthy skin, but they also help to prevent a host of other medical conditions and diseases, and are general good pieces of advice to abide by. Because as someone who deals with complex chronic diseases personally, as a specialist in general internal medicine, sure, I have things at my disposal that can help prevent heart attacks and help to treat heart failure and help to prevent strokes. But nothing's better than public prevention and primary prevention. Good diet, routine exercise, good quality of sleep, restorative and restful sleep, good habits, all of these things together help to build the foundation. And the medications and treatments that we give on top of that should only serve as a complement to the lifestyle factors and healthy living that people should adopt to maintain good health, good skin, and good hair. But it's nice to hear that there's a lot of extra things that we can do to maintain that youthful Greek-looking appearance, if that's something that you so desire to have. I found that conversation was really informative, really interesting and eye-opening. Overall, as I feel with all guests that I have in the studio, I learned a ton today. I'm definitely going to apply that learning in counseling and conversations that I have with patients, but also to my own skin health and also in conversations that I have with friends and family members, because this is definitely a hot topic and one that I get asked a lot of questions about. But my understanding and knowledge of the skin is actually quite limited. And this was very helpful and very informative. And I look forward to applying that in all of my conversations and journeys down the line. I want to give another shout out to everybody in the listening audience for tuning in today and for absorbing this episode. Be sure to rate and review it on any of the streaming platforms that you use. I'm always interested in feedback. I'm always interested in growing. I want to give a shout out to my team, Cameron, my producer, Richie, my engineer, to all of the people working behind the scenes on social media and web design, Priya, Moyez, Adil. Thanks so much to everyone for coming together. It's been a pleasure to work with you all and to create these fun episodes. Looking forward to seeing everybody next week on the show. Take care and have a great day. Thanks for listening to Ditch the Lab Coat with Dr. Bonta, the home of science-based skepticism. Tune in next Wednesday for another healthcare conversation. For more information, please visit labcoat.fm.